This is Dojo Live, Tech Without Borders, stories that bring us together. Hello, and welcome to this week's second show, or excuse me, show on Dojo Live, Wednesday, May 3rd, 2023. My name is Kim Lantis, and it's my pleasure to be joined by co-host America Guerrero today. Hi, America. I don't know if it's just me or not, but there's a bit of a delay. I'm going to roll with it. Today's guest is James Ame, who is the founder and CEO of Vistum Labs. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so fun to be part of the conversation.
Thank you. And it's going to be a great conversation. We're already talking a bit of pre-show backstage there, and we've learned a lot already. I'm super excited to dive into today's topic, which is all about artificial intelligence, dementia, diagnostics. But before we get into that component of the show today, we'd love to know you a bit better. What's your story, James? What's your passion, and what sort of led up to the founding of Vistum Labs?
Yeah, so thank you for the question. The story is always, in my opinion, the most fun part. The story is the why, right? Whenever we do something like start a business or something else that's very challenging and takes up a huge amount of our time, it's important to know why we're doing it. So for me, my parents are both physicians. And as a result, I always love building technologies for doctors. I've always thought about how to help patients. And I didn't want to be a doctor myself. So there are these sort of like conflating values that have always been pushing me towards this direction. And while I was starting initially in my career to not be a doctor, you know, I was making video games and selling those. I was making websites. I was making apps. I've even started, you know, a nonprofit and a marketing company and all sorts of things. You still end up following what you, I guess, are used to and comfortable with. And the truth is, I like communicating with doctors. I know how they prefer to communicate. I know what matters to them. And I know what stops them from providing effective patient care. So those were the things that led me towards starting my first neurotech business, which is called Neurable. Neurable was initially created to help people who are in wheelchairs control their life. What a lot of people don't realize is that if you're in your wheelchair, it's not obvious, it's not always the case that you have control over your arms. So what happens if you are a quadriplegic? How do you move around the world? So what we did is we created a mind reading technology that could tell the direction the person wanted to move in. And I'm very proud to say that that's quite a successful company now. And I've continued in the neurotech space now with Vistum Labs, which is, in my opinion, addressing a more significantly clinical problem, which is the diagnosis of these patients.
Yes, for sure. And specifically the diagnosis of dementia. Let's dive into Vistum Labs and the problem that you're helping to solve.
Yeah, sure. So I'm not a doctor. I'm also not even a PhD, although I do have a publication in a very prestigious journal. So I'm proud of that.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So we decided to go after dementia first. Dementia is something that is difficult to quantify, difficult to evaluate, and yet it's so freaking apparent. When you have a patient who is starting to develop something like Alzheimer's disease, or, you know, maybe they have a stroke, maybe they have, you know, a vascular-induced dementia, what happens is this person is suffering, and we're not able to truly know the reasons why. We know there's something wrong with their brain. We can sort of see the way that that affects their behavior and their ability to remember things and to have abstract rational thought. But at the moment, it's very difficult to know, well, is this patient worse than this other patient who we've seen? How do we adjust the dosage? What therapy is working for this patient? What hasn't worked? These are questions that currently go unanswered. At the moment, you might get your therapy and it might not be the right one. There's no follow-up to see that the therapy is effective. And so that's the problem that really I want to address first and foremost. And one reason why I'm so interested in this space is that half of patients who end up using wheelchairs, it's because they suffer from, in my opinion, a preventable disorder, a preventative, preventable neurodegenerative disorder. And so I'm hoping actually to prevent people from ending up in the wheelchair.
Wow, that's fantastic. And if we can get some scope here in terms of numbers, perhaps, of really how relevant this is, what percentage of individuals were, let's quantify this a little, number of individuals suffer from dementia. And then if we want to, you know, expand that out, what does that mean for people? How many people are going to come in contact or intimately know someone with this? Like, it's not unique, right?
Yeah, so I want to make sure that I give you the most accurate numbers. It's looking like in the U.S., the CDC says that 6 million Americans have Alzheimer's today. That's a very terrible number. If you look at the breakdown of demographics, what you'll see is that approximately one third of American elderly end up developing Alzheimer's disease. So it is quite a prevalent condition. And something else that really needs to be said is, well, two very important things, is that we don't have equal access to healthcare when we're talking about Alzheimer's disease specifically. This is a disease that really the treatments aren't available around the world. You have to be in America, or you have to be in Europe or Japan in order to get some of the best healthcare. PET scan machines, for example, which are commonly used for Alzheimer's, the average country doesn't even have one of those machines. So there's a big inequality here in terms of access to care. And another big problem that also addresses, in my opinion, inequality is Alzheimer's disproportionately affects women. In fact, women are twice as likely to have Alzheimer's than men.
Wow. So if we break that down in what we're seeing right now on screen, you are a man, America and I are women, we're three people. So statistically, one of the three of us will get Alzheimer's, and more than likely it will be America or I, if we make it to be, you know, of an elderly age. That's insane.
That's the scope
shocking. Insane. Yes. So if we rock, paper, scissors, America, like I'm, So this is fantastic. And there's still a chance, but less, right? So let's deep dive into today's conversation and exactly what you're doing with artificial intelligence.
So as mentioned, we have these amazing technologies, right? We have things like the PET scan, the MRI is something I'm a fan of. We have cerebral spinal fluids that we can get from a lumbar puncture. But these are not, in my opinion, the best tests, especially when we're looking at what to do with a patient who walks in the door of the clinic for the first time, or even early into their disease. A very common story that I hear from patients and just people in my network who I interview is that a person will think that they have Alzheimer's or some other condition. They will go see their doctor and they'll say, "Hey, I can't remember my way to the grocery store. I always need my phone, which I didn't usually need. I can't remember the password to my door of my apartment." You know, very little things, but they add up. And the doctor says, "Well, do you know who the president is? Do you know the country you live in? Do you know what year it is?" And the unfortunate reality is, if you can do that, if you can count backwards from 100, then by the clinical current gold standard, you probably do not have a disorder. However, does that mean that you won't develop a disorder? Definitely not. Does that mean you don't have brain damage right now? Definitely not. And yet, these are patients who we send home and we don't treat. And as I said before, I think that we are being way too retroactive with healthcare. I think that if we're able to detect these diseases early, treat early, then the patient doesn't have to end up with symptoms. So that's the modus that I want to change.
What is the difference between Alzheimer and dementia? Because as you said before the show, dementia is not a disease, but Alzheimer, it is a disease. So I want to know.
Yeah, and also, Kim, I want to make sure I answered your question well. Did you also want the context of AI?
Yeah, I think we'll dive. Let's address Alzheimer's versus dementia, disease, not disease. And then we can dive into exactly how Vistam works and how we're getting to these important diagnostics.
Yeah. So once again, since I'm not a doctor, I am going to read this description from the Oxford Dictionary. So dementia is not a disease. It's a group of symptoms that describe a set of diseases. So the definition here says dementia is a group of conditions characterized by impairment of at least two brain functions, which I listed previously. So such as memory loss, judgments. The symptoms include forgetfulness, memory, limited social skills, and thinking. And so that's why something like Alzheimer's falls under dementia. And in fact, it's arguable that maybe Parkinson's could fall into that category, even though that has more physical properties. Certainly, Lewy body disease, vascular dementia, these would also fall under the dementia category.
All right, so we're looking at this more in terms of symptoms and then diagnosing.
I should add, by the way, there are over 100 different types of dementia currently recognized. Yeah. There are exactly 105.
Which you're not going to get from asking somebody to count backwards from 100, right?
well, that's the main problem. If you don't know what type
exactly.
of dementia it has, you can't give them the right treatment.
So how does it work? What is Wisdom doing?
Well, you asked me earlier about statistics, and there's actually the most important statistic that I haven't shared with you yet, which is when a patient goes to see, you know, their doctor for the first time, and not just for the first time, for actually the first 10 years of going to this doctor with this condition, they're misdiagnosed approximately 65% of the time. Dementia patients today, 65% of them are initially misdiagnosed for the first 10 years of the disease.
And that 10 years, I imagine, is an extremely valuable window of opportunity to either pause or potentially reverse whatever might be happening.
That is the window of opportunity. Mm-hmm. If we wait, wow. You know, and by the way, we've had therapies for things like Alzheimer's disease since the 1990s that are very effective. You know, not saying that as a doctor, but because I'm not, but I've heard that from doctors. They're proponents of these therapies. One treatment, for example, called galantamine, it can actually allow you to preserve cognitive function for about 5 years into the disease if you're taking it. And that's, again, that's after getting your proper diagnosis, probably 10 years into the disease. Who knows what happens if you're able to get it, you know, I would say more on time.
Exactly. And enter Wisdom Labs. What does this diagnostic look like? What's your technology look like? What's this neurotech and the AI component to make it all happen?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's a great question. There's one more thing I want to add to the problem. I'm sorry, but it is a little complicated.
No, I think it makes a lot of sense. We need to understand the problem before we can get to the solution.
Yeah, so we're currently misdiagnosing most of our dementia patients, most of them. That's just the U.S. These are only U.S. statistics. So we misdiagnose most of our patients. One of the reasons that we misdiagnose these patients is because we have all these different endpoints. For example, the questionnaire that I just shared with you, there are many that exist. That's one of the endpoints. The list is very long, honestly. A comprehensive list would be 10 to 20 endpoints. So that's why it actually takes you so long to get your proper diagnosis. Because, okay, fine, maybe you answered the questions and you seem healthy. But if we had done a PET scan on you, we would see that, oh, wait, there's actually something going on. If we did an MRI, there's actually something going on. Right. So the problem is right now that these endpoints are staged. We do them one by one. We're not doing them all at once. And it's not feasible to do them all at once. They're also very costly. And so what Wisdom has done is we've created a new way to look into the brain and see what's happening. What we do is we put an EEG cap on the person, which has been done in the past, but we put an EEG cap on the person and we actually have them watch a video. And the video is designed by a psychiatrist at Columbia. It's a specially designed video that actually triggers a bunch of different functions in the visual cortex of the brain. And those functions also move up into other areas of the brain. And what we end up with is a system that actually is measuring how the person is responding to the video and shows us where there's breakdown in brain activity. Our visual cortex, you two may be women, I may be a man, but we still have the same visual functions, right? Otherwise, we would be living different lives. For survival reasons, right? For Darwinism and all this, we have extremely sophisticated visual cortexes and ours are very much the same. And so what our system does really is it looks at that part of the brain that is the same across people and it can see, oh my gosh, there's a breakdown here. There's a breakdown there. Our brains are a lot like the AI systems that we use today. You know, we have specialized neurons that detect edges of images, that track images that are moving, and they're different neurons, right? We actually have different neurons for—
And they even fill in the gaps, right? Of things that you're not even seeing. Like, you know enough to like just give the context of what I must have seen.
Yeah, well, this is super cool too. We have different neurons, literally physically different, located in like slightly different, but physically different parts of the brain, for, you know, a perfectly vertical line and one that's like slightly tilted. Those are different neurons. It's not like the same neuron and it's trying to figure out if it's rotated. No, they're separate neurons that detect different lines. So you can actually be blind to a certain orientation of a line. It's crazy. But anyway, so that's a long story. Just to say that we have this technology, we're measuring how the brain is losing its function, because any type of brain damage is going to most likely affect the visual cortex. It's the largest part of your brain. And so what we're able to see is that, okay, wow, there's this brain damage, it's in this area, and we use AI to interpret that brain damage and to produce the results that we would look for. So you want a PET scan, you want an MRI, you want any of these tests, you want a spinal tap? Well, our technology can actually provide that for you. It's not a PET scan, but it can estimate the PET scan results with very high accuracy, very high confidence. And what this does for the doctor is, yeah, they want all the endpoints on the patient, and they don't have time to send the person to the PET scan machine right away. Well, they can use our test, and our test is going to show them, yeah, this patient, they need to do a PET scan. This patient needs an MRI. This patient, like, this is the endpoint you need to test. This is the one that's going to reveal what the problem is. And so that's why what we're doing is changing the world for the better.
How old do you need to be to start doing these tests? For me, that I'm 24 years old, when do I need to start thinking about those diseases that I might have in the future?
Yeah, so I have to say that it does vary based on the disease. You know, there are some conditions that start very early, which is very sad. But in my opinion, you know, statistically, I would say that starting around the age of 35, 40, that's usually when someone might start to experience a disease. Typically in the Alzheimer's space, you know, a clinical study will look at people who are ages 50 and up, mostly because the symptoms are pretty severe. Or at least pretty easy to document at that stage. So I would say 40 years old would probably be the best time.
Yeah, this is fantastic. You know, I'm reaching the age now where I realize that I need to maybe take care of that. There are times when I catch myself standing outside my house and I'm looking at my keys and I'm like, which one am I needing right now? Oh yeah.
We do not have a test like this. Okay, so we have ultrasound, right? To see if you, I have something wrong with my stomach, maybe I have an appendicitis, right? We have ultrasound. I think something's wrong with my heart. We can do EKG, we can do, you know, blood pressure. Oh, there's something wrong. With the brain, we got nothing. You go to see your doctor and they have to, it's part of the standard. They have to ask you those questions. You know, what year is it? Where do you live? Another question that they might ask you is, can you, like, here's a picture, draw it again. It's super subjective. And a lot of people are going to get a perfect score.
Yeah. I mean, it's fantastic. And again, to your point, the other tests that currently exist are either very expensive, maybe not even accessible in not just the city where you live, but the entire country where you live. And then it's not like the type of your body where you're like, let's just go explore this and see, right? It just doesn't work that way. I mean, it's your brain. But, you know, what you're saying really reminds me of a past show that we had not too long ago, and that was with digital diagnostics and Seth Rainford. What they do is they have the ability to, I believe, if I recall correctly, with vision scans and different tests that doctors are utilizing or able to utilize specifically with people with diabetes and things. So they really get this care, this access, you know, in like more rural areas and different places, that's very reliable, very affordable, and very preventative. So I'm seeing a lot of these overlaps in what it is that you are trying to accomplish. So let's talk about the portability of your technology and what that means in terms of accessibility.
Yeah, that's a great question. A PET scan might not be available to you. In fact, even if you have a PET scan and you can afford to pay for it, it's not covered by insurance, by the way, then you are probably going to get one in a couple months, if you're lucky. You know, these systems are in high demand. They're used for a variety of disorders and diseases. And with our test, it's 30 minutes. It's EEG. It's a video. You could do it at your own home. There are EEG devices that do that. Our plan is just to give the device directly to the doctor so that they can just do it in their clinic. We think that's the best place because the patient goes to the clinic for their first visit. So they're already there. But that's our answer to the portability question and availability.
That's great. That's great. And in terms of, let's say, usability, you know, doctors, they're doctors. Their goal isn't to be the computer guy, the tech guy. Go ahead.
Yeah. Like, how does this look like implemented? You put on the headset on the patients. A nurse can do that. You could have a tech do it as well if you wanted them to be, you know, specially trained for that. And then you turn on the video and that's it. I mean, EEG is already common practice in neurology clinics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the staff is already there. The doctor doesn't have to perform it themselves. You turn on the video, you walk away. You come back 30 minutes later, the patient's done. The patient experience is also very simple. You watch a video. There's not more else that's asked of you. And it's a non-invasive test. You know, you're not asked to lie down on a table and expose your spine and then have someone put a really thick needle into your back. You're not asked to drink radioactive fluid and, you know, fast and then sit in a, like a PET scan machine. So it really is a pretty painless experience. And I personally love the idea of being able to just ship EEG systems, even to other countries, or to areas that may not have clinics that have, you know, everything that they need. And then just do a quick scan, send it back. The patient gets the help that they need.
I wanted to ask you that. Go ahead. If you just provide this in the US, or are you planning, or are you already providing this in other countries, or how are you helping around the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we haven't worked with other countries yet. Honestly, we haven't even necessarily worked with hospitals yet in the US. So far, we've done clinical studies, but that's where everything changes this year. So I recently raised a sizable amount of money. I recently hired a full-time team, and we are going to market this year. We will be with in hospitals this year. We already have hospitals lined up on our wait list. We also have individual clinical practices on our wait list. The first country that we may launch to after the US is Japan, mostly because we have some investors with relationships over there, and we have as well interested Japanese hospital groups that would like to use the technology. It'll still be staged. You know, we are a US first company. We are based in the US. It should work here first. But yeah, I mean, we see great opportunities in Japan and even in France. I actually speak French. So I already have the relationships that I need.
That's the French that I learned, your proper pronunciation of your last name before we got onto the show. I love it. That's really exciting. First of all, congratulations. Very exciting, big news for you and Vistem Labs. And I think everyone in terms of diagnostics and those that dementia can and will affect. My question, and exciting too, I think, in terms of data, you know, with the artificial intelligence, what do you expect, you know, once you're able to actually deploy and you're seeing things and you're gathering more data sets, how do you expect for this to impact your technology? What comes next?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that question. Alzheimer's is not the only form of dementia, and dementia is not the only form of brain damage. So I see this as a continuum. I see that as we build more ability to collect patient data, what happens is we expand our utility into other disease categories. And you know, I think traumatic brain injuries are one area that I'm personally interested in that. One area that we seem to be moving in quickly is actually the Parkinson's disease category. Parkinson's doesn't have as many endpoints as Alzheimer's disease. You know, at least for now with Alzheimer's, you can get a PET scan. It's in the realm of possibility. With Parkinson's, you know, there was a new article, the first one to come out to say, hey, spinal taps maybe have a biomarker for Parkinson's. That's the only one that we know of right now.
Wow. Talking about ideas, we have a comment from Antonio Suna. He's also watching. He says, hi, thanks for the amazing talk. James, they say life exceeds fiction. Also, many things that are real today were once only ideas in sci-fi movies. What do you think about this? Can you confirm?
Yeah, you know, it's one of the reasons I got into science is I love reading science fiction, and I got frustrated with imagining all these things that I thought were possible and not having them, right? Like you read a book about a flying car and you want one. I think that a lot of what we build, we imagine first. I think that that's an inherent process of the creative journey. And I also think that, you know, no one really has unique thought. I think that, you know, humans think about problems and ways to solve them. And there are 7 billion people on the planet. So we've probably all had similar thoughts. And some of those people are writers. They put it into words. And yeah, it becomes this culture. The more that we can describe about it, the more likely it is to come true, the easier it is to understand. For Vistam specifically, you know, I can't think of a book or a movie that gave me inspiration. But that said, there are lots of science fiction, you know, movies and books that talk about a table, a smart medical bench that you sit on, you lie down on, and it does like a whole scan of your body, and it tells you, you know, everything that's wrong with it. And I definitely think that Vistam fits into that playbook of, okay, maybe it's not a table, but it's a hat, and maybe it doesn't tell you your whole body, but it tells you your brain. So, yeah, I mean, I think we are definitely bringing science fiction to life.
That is super fun. And you just touched on something that I would like to talk about as we wrap up and come to the end of today's show. And this is the idea of 7 billion people, culture. You mentioned Japan. I believe that you just came back from there. What has this, in terms of what you've seen around the world, these 7 billion people, cross-cultural experiences? What's this been like for you in terms of a leader as an individual, and where you see maybe that component of your company culture or just Vistam in general growing? Any sort of words of wisdom that you might have for other people like yourself who are looking to, push globally?
Yeah, so something I'll share about me personally is that one of my greatest passions is actually languages. It's maybe my number one passion outside hip hop dancing, which I also like. But it's the passion I've had for the longest by far. And it's something that motivates me every day. You know, I grew up speaking French and English. I learned Chinese and Spanish very quickly. In college, I started to familiarize myself with other languages. And when I travel, you know, I like to pick things up along the way. I was in Sweden just last month for a scientific conference, and now I can say a couple words. You know, it makes me happy. It's something that genuinely makes me happy. It's what I like to do. I think that loving languages has given me an advantage because when I meet people who are from different countries, they see that in me and they want to work with me because most likely they're someone else like that, right? Like, oh, they want to speak to an American, they want to learn English. Well, I'm on the flip side. I want to learn maybe Japanese. And so those create friendships. I think that friendships are the key, not only to, you know, who you work with within your company. A lot of the people in my team, you know, we became friends first before they joined. But I think it's also important to business. And the thing about friendship is that it's sincere. It's not ulterior motive. It's not, you know, being friends with specific people and not with others. I think that taking an approach, this is a word of wisdom, of you know, recognizing that anyone in your life can be an important friend of yours and you just don't know them yet. I think that that's a very important perspective to have.
That's fantastic. And another thing I'm hearing in your story is just this willingness, right? This willingness and this spirit of adventure to try to go for it and to do something that's maybe different, or experience something that's different than what you know or what you have
Oh
known.
yeah,
I think that's
and
really
look,
exciting.
it comes with bad experiences too. You know, another thing I like to do is I like to try exotic foods. And I went to a Chinese restaurant once in Boston. I asked for duck tongue, which I've never
You're
had
like, give me
before.
the weirdest thing on your menu.
I didn't ask for that. I just looked at the menu and I said, I don't know what this is. I'll have it. It was a waitress. She comes over and she says, "Are you sure? Have you had this before? You probably won't like it." And you know, I said, no, I want it. And it was, you know, this is an opinion, but it was the grossest thing I've ever had. You know, that's the risk. That's
is this a texture component or a taste, all of the above? What made it
There were a lot of factors. The thing that freaked me out the most was that, well, first of all, duck tongues have bones in them, apparently. But the thing that freaked me out the most was that it felt like I was chewing on my own tongue. Like, it had the same texture as my own tongue. I was scared that I was going to bite my tongue while trying to eat this thing. So yeah, that wasn't very pleasant, but I will say that it's always worth the risk. It's always worth the risk. I think that humans in our behavioral programming, we're very, risk resistant, right? We like our comfort. We don't like those bad experiences, and we sometimes like put a little too much weight on them, because the truth is that life is so magical. The world is so big. I would eat duck tongue every day for the rest of my life. If that's what it took in order for me to continue living the way that I do, which means meeting new people, finding foods that I actually love. I used to think that I hated Japanese curry. You know, it's something that I tried in America. So everyone likes sushi, right? I like sushi, but Japanese curry, I thought, oh, I like Indian curry better. In Japan, I had the best Japanese curry of my life. And now I feel like, wow, I really can't say that I hate any food group, because maybe it's just the way it's prepared. I mean, that curry was fantastic. I dream about it. it's worth it. I think it's worth it. Life is this beautiful roller coaster.
For sure. And it's the curry that's got you motivated to head back to Japan. I love it. Well, James, it has been a pleasure to get to know you today, to learn about Vistam Labs, what you're doing, to make diagnostics of dementia just accessible, easy, fast. It's so important. Thank you so much. And of course, we wish you nothing but success as you move forward. And we'll have to have you back on the show again as things develop. Second round, you're going to have to do a hip hop demonstration. That's something else I learned about you. That's absolutely fantastic. Stick around here as we go off air here in just a minute. But to our viewers, thank you again for joining us on Dojo Live. Catch us on Monday as we do our recap show. And of course, our introducing next week's shows as well. We've got a whole three. The week is booked for us Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays here with Adaptive, Princeton Consultants, and Glean. So don't miss it. See you on Monday, 10 o'clock Pacific. Thank you, James. Thank you, Mirka. And bye for now.
Check out past episodes, transcripts, blogs, and more on our website, dojo.nearsoft.com.